Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, September 15, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing document retention and communication in the federal government. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome three experts to our call today. We're going to have a moderator. He's Mr. Adam R. Perlman. I'm going to leave it to him to introduce the other two speakers and to run the program from here. So with that, Mr. Perlman, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Public Service and Private Servers, the Law of Government Information Retention and Security, Federal Society Teleform, brought to you by the International and National Security Law Practice Group. My name is Adam Perlman, and I'll be moderating today's call. I must begin by noting there was an error in one of the promotional emails for this teleform yesterday that resulted in my DOD title being listed. Please note that my participation as moderator today is my personal capacity. The views expressed on this call do not necessarily represent the views of DOD nor any government agency, and my participation should not be construed as an endorsement of the opinions expressed by our experts today, Messrs. Coffin and Sales. And with that, we can jump right into the substance of this interesting and timely topic. Now, by way of background, while searching for materials responsive to a request from the House of Representatives Select Committee on Benghazi made last year, State Department could not locate a single email sent to or from an official government email address for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It has since been learned that Secretary Clinton had hired a former campaign staffer to set up a server for privately registered domain names to be kept physically in one of her homes, and that she used an email address associated with her ClintonEmail.com domain hosted by that server to conduct all of her official email business while serving as Secretary of State. When she left office, she gave custody of her server to a private internet company to maintain, but did not turn her emails over to the State Department until specifically asked for them as part of the House Committee's investigation. In doing so, Secretary Clinton produced roughly 30,000 printed copies of emails from that server, but also withheld nearly as many after her lawyers identified them as personal in nature and may or may not have subsequently wiped the server clean, that is, deleting and then overwriting the data on it. Of the emails that she provided to the State Department, so far nearly 200 have been found to contain classified information, with some reportedly containing top-secret satellite intelligence. Inspectors General from both the Department of State and the intelligence community referred the security breach to the Federal Bureau of Investigation for further investigation. Although it was not referred to the FBI as a criminal matter, and the FBI itself has said it is merely conducting a counterintelligence damage assessment, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey nevertheless has noted that the FBI investigates people, not machines. Further, there are a number of other legal and policy issues implicated as more is learned about the existence of the private server, as well as the content of the information that it was used to transmit. This teleform features the expertise of Professor Nathan Sales, a law professor at Syracuse University College of Law, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, and a veteran of the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, as well as that of Shannon Coffin, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department Civil Division, and later counsel to Vice President Dick Cheney. They will discuss several of the national security, criminal, and regulatory dimensions of the Clinton email controversy and related current events. Some of the matters addressed today include whether Secretary Clinton's private server was allowed, as she has repeatedly insisted, what laws and regulations are implicated by her practices, what is the danger of the nation's top diplomat communicating via private servers, how did it put national security information at risk, does it matter that the emails were, quote, not marked classified at the time? What would it take to show Clinton or her aides knowingly transmitted classified information in violation of federal law? Does the former secretary's role as an original classification authority factor in? What are the notion proposed by the former director of the Information Security Oversight Office that certain information is born classified? How does this compare to the actions of retired general and former CIA director David Petraeus? What was Clinton's was Clinton's activity covered by the Electronic Records Act, and need that law be amended? And what about the Freedom of Information Act? Before getting into the classified information and criminal law issues, we first turn to Mr. Coffin to spend a few minutes orienting us to the laws and agency guidelines of federal records keeping and private email accounts. Shannon?
Thank you, Adam. So before we start, I want everyone out there to speak up if you ever thought you'd be doing a conference call on the Federal Records Act. Yeah, that's what I thought. But that's where we start. We start the question that has been most asked based on talking points that you see from the Clinton camp in this circumstance is, was this all allowed? And the answer to that begins with the Federal Records Act, which requires that the head of every federal agency, in this case the Secretary of State, shall make and preserve records containing adequate documentation about the organization's functions and procedures and transactions of the agency during their tenure. With respect to written records, that has for years simply required that files be maintained. And since the mid-1990s, the federal government has grappled with the question of how to deal with electronic records. And there are obviously continuing issues in that area. For instance, there are many forms of social communication, social media these days that don't allow the user to preserve a record. Just one thing comes to mind is Snapchat, for instance. And quite literally, government lawyers have been, you know, dealing with how do we deal with official communications over such media for quite some time. With respect to email, in 1995, during the Clinton administration, the archivist, the National Archives and Records Administration, adopted regulations which required the preservation of official emails, not only those created in official accounts, but those created in non-official accounts. The archivist interpreted the Federal Records Act to apply to email records and further provided that agencies with access to external electronic email systems shall ensure that those records sent or received on those systems are preserved in the appropriate record-keeping system. So you could argue that since 1995, it's been very clear that external emails had to be preserved as official records. The folks that I have spoken to in this field, many of whom I used to represent in my capacity as Deputy Assistant Attorney General when they were at the National Archives, have said that regulation caused some confusion. It wasn't exactly clear what the scope of that regulation was, and agencies didn't really understand their obligations with respect to email records for much of the decade that followed. The archivist adopted a new regulation in 2009 after a GAO study said that agencies just weren't doing a very good job of preserving emails. And that regulation quite plainly said that if an agency allows the use of external email systems or even commercial email systems such as Gmail, Yahoo, and the like, they had to take steps to make sure that the individual employees were preserving their records, which could be done most readily by simply forwarding a copy of the email to an official email account associated with that employee. And that regulation, which was adopted in 2009, was codified by Congress in 2013. For those in the field, it's been pretty plain, and certainly best practices have been since the mid-90s, that email records had to be preserved. Often that was done before agencies had sophisticated preservation systems for electronic records, was done by simply printing out the emails. But During my tenure at the Department of Justice, for instance, we were told that all of our emails were archived. So the answer to the question of, was this allowed in terms of was Hillary Clinton in this case allowed to use a private email system, was she required to save those emails during her tenure? Well, at least under the Federal Records Act, there certainly was permission, or at least an allowance, for private emails to be used, provided that they were preserved. But the next layer of that gets into government policy as opposed to simply law, and the question of whether she was allowed to use her email system exclusively really requires you to take a look at State Department policy, which since 2005 in the State Department's Foreign Affairs Manual has said quite plainly that it is the policy of the Department of State that the day-to-day business of the Department of State shall be conducted over official email systems. There is an exception that allows private email to be used, but only in exceptional circumstances where access to the official server is not available, as when there's a server outage or the like, and only then when the employee considers the security risks that are involved with using commercial email. So as a matter of policy, State Department policy has been, since well before Hillary Clinton's tenure, not to allow the exclusive use of email on a private server, and that shouldn't come as much of a surprise. With that, I will turn over the issue of classification issues that have arisen to Nathan.
All right, thanks, Shannon, and thanks, everyone, for participating in today's call. I'd like to spend a couple of minutes talking about the most applicable criminal statutes that might come into play here, and then spend a couple of minutes talking about some of the national security implications of using a private server for government business. There are at least two statutes that come into play. Now, this is not to say that Secretary Clinton herself might face liability under these statutes, but it's increasingly likely that somebody at the State Department, perhaps a staffer or IT person, may have run afoul of some of these criminal prohibitions. So the first one is the federal statute on mishandling classified information. As you might expect, it generally forbids government officials, those who are entrusted with classified information, from knowingly removing it from protected systems with the intent to retain those materials at an unauthorized location. So that the key element of that offense, it seems to me, is the mens rea. It must be that the person in question knew that the information in question was classified when the data was removed or mishandled. Second statute is the ominously titled Espionage Act. Of course, it doesn't just criminalize spying on behalf of the Soviet Union or a foreign government. It more generally seeks to regulate the storage, use, transmission of information relating to the national defense. So one of the subsections of the Espionage Act makes it a crime to take information that relates to the national defense and through gross negligence allow it to be removed from its proper place of custody or allow it to be destroyed or allow it to be lost. So removing the information from its proper place of custody is a crime, and it's also a separate crime if you have knowledge that the information has been removed to fail to notify authorities that the information is being stored in an improper place. So in both of these statutes, the key question, as I said, is knowledge. Not to sound Nixonian, but the question here is, what did Secretary Clinton know and when did she know it? So to start to think through that problem, it's helpful to take a quick detour and look at what so far we know was in those emails. The Inspectors General of the State Department and of the intelligence community have put out a number of figures. X number of emails have been reviewed. Y number of emails have contained classified information. So this is just a short snapshot. We know that at least two emails so far have been deemed to have contained top secret information. That is the highest level of classification under the statutes and executive orders governing classified information. That means that if top secret information is released, its release would cause exceptionally grave harm to the national security. We know that several emails contain top secret information. One of them was stamped TS/SI/TK/NoForeign. Now, that's an awful lot of alphabet soup gobbledygook. Let me translate it for those of you who didn't minor in government bureaucraties. TS means top secret. SI means special intelligence. That's a reference to signals intelligence or communications intelligence, essentially electronic eavesdropping of the sort that's done by the NSA, intercepting phone calls, emails, and so on. TK is a reference to Talent Keyhole. That is another compartmented intelligence program that involves the use of satellites, either for imagery, taking photographs, or for other forms of electronic surveillance. No foreign means you can't share it with foreign citizens. We also know that an email, perhaps one of these two top secret emails, contained information derived from U.S. military sources about the movement of hostile troops in Libya. Right? Now, troop movements, information about troop movements, is sort of the gold standard of classified information. It's difficult to imagine information that is more closely held than that. In fact, the Supreme Court, in a series of cases going back to the 1920s, has said that information about troop movements is so sensitive that the First Amendment might even contemplate a prior restraint on the press releasing that kind of information because of the national security harms that could result from the disclosure of troop movement information. Less sensitive but still classified is foreign government information. Reuters has done a series of reports over the past month looking at the releases that the State Department has made in response to FOIA requests and looking very closely at what information has been redacted and the stated justification for redacting that information. It turns out that an awful lot of the emails that were sent over the server contained information derived from foreign governments. Reports from Tony Blair, information from Benjamin Netanyahu, information from foreign ministers. Now, under the applicable executive order, information from foreign governments is, quote, born classified. Well, that's actually not a quote from the executive order, but it's presumed to be classified. And the reason for that is fairly straightforward. We need to treat with the utmost confidentiality information given to us by our foreign partners, because if we don't, they'll go silent. So this is a way of inducing cooperation from foreign governments, assuring them that we will treat the information they share with our government with the appropriate degree of confidence. So back to the question, what did Secretary Clinton know? What did her State Department colleagues know about the classified status of this information? Well, in at least some cases, it appears that they had actual knowledge that at least some of the information was classified. Reuters reported an email exchange between Secretary Clinton and one of her staffers in which the staffer said, we got a report from a foreign counterpart. I'm happy to talk secure with you about it. The staffer was clearly aware that this was sensitive information that should be discussed only in a secure setting. The response from Secretary Clinton was, just send it, and he apparently did. More broadly, it might be possible to infer from the surrounding circumstances that the State Department officials, including Secretary Clinton, knew the information was classified. Some information is so manifestly sensitive that anybody with a background in national security or foreign affairs would simply know on the face that this is the sort of stuff that you have to treat with the utmost caution. Like, troop movements is a good example of this. If you're getting information in your inbox about troop movements, then that's a very good sign that it should be treated with appropriate safeguards.
Nathan, do we lose you? Shannon?
Well, this is what happens when you talk about Hillary Clinton's emails.
Well.
But look, while Nathan is getting back on this call, let me jump back to the criminal issues surrounding just the existence of the server, because we've talked about the policy implications. The issue of whether Hillary Clinton could sort of keep the server in her home and then delete 30,000 emails and not return them on her. Separation from government implicates several statutes that deal with preservation of federal records. And the Federal Records Act has a criminal counterpart to it in 18 U.S.C. 2071 that makes it a felony, actually punishable not only by up to 3 years in prison, but by debarment from federal office. And I will note that provision certainly couldn't apply to the presidency, given that Congress can't, by statute, limit the terms of the presidency. But it creates a felony crime for any custodian of federal records to conceal, alter, or destroy those federal records. Now, arguably, given the facts that we know, all three of those possibilities are in play. The concealment issue comes up because Hillary Clinton did not subject any of her records to FOIA searches or any official inquiry during her tenure in office and almost 2 years thereafter. When she did return records, it's been reported that some of those have been redacted or altered. Depending on what's in the 30,000 records and whether the FBI is able to recover them, and there are big issues there, we may find out that, she destroyed federal records as well. So 2071B, I think, has been, a provision that's been in play from the beginning of this dispute, controversy, and also, obviously, provisions in federal law that deal with obstruction and even anticipatory obstruction. In a statute that was enacted in the aftermath of the Enron scandal, Congress made it a crime to destroy records not only that are subject to a federal inquiry, but in anticipation of such a federal inquiry. As a result, Hillary Clinton, certainly has issues to answer for it, under that statute as well. So it's the simple question of whether, using a private email system or a private email account on occasion while she was Secretary of State does not answer the broader questions of whether using that system exclusively and not returning the records upon separation from the Department of State, whether that sort of behavior is allowed. And as a matter of not simply State Department policy and procedure, but as a matter of criminal law, there are serious questions there. I think Nathan is back on the line.
Well, Well, while we get him, Shannon, on your point about concealment, is there
I am back.
Okay.
Just
sorry,
as I was about
ahead,
to
Nathan.
Start talking about Chinese and Russian hackers, my phone went dead, so I'm not sure if that's
a coincidence
or not.
Well, if you want to go talk about Chinese and Russian hackers, it's a great time to do it.
Excellent. So why does this matter? So the question is important for political reasons, as it's obviously been a front page issue for Hillary's campaign that she'd rather not deal with. But more important from the national security standpoint, there's the question of what sort of harm can be done from private servers being used to transact government business, including business involving classified information. We don't yet know whether foreign intelligence services were able to penetrate whatever defenses Secretary Clinton had. However, I think they might have done so. Media reports have indicated that Sidney Blumenthal, close Clinton advisor on the outside, had his America Online account hacked through spear phishing, and hackers were able to take control of that account. It's not inconceivable that they could have used similar techniques to gain access to Hillary's server. So what is spear phishing? Well, you're sitting at your desk, you open up an email from a friend that says, hey, check out this Word document. And you dutifully click on the attachment. Only the email wasn't actually sent by your friend. It was sent by a Romanian hacker who has impersonated your friend's account. And the Word document wasn't an ordinary attachment. It contained malware that allowed the hacker to gain access and take control of your system. That may well have happened, but it's simply too soon to say. I imagine that's one of the things that the FBI forensics teams are looking at right now. That's a first-order harm, the compromise of classified information by foreign intelligence services. There's, however, a second-order harm that we should also keep our eye on and be concerned about, and that is the chilling effect on the willingness of other governments to share information with us. Again, the reason why foreign government information is born classified is to induce our foreign partners to share information. They're going to be a lot less likely to do so if we can't credibly assure them that we're going to treat that information with the utmost confidentiality. So there's a risk that Tony Blair, Benjamin Netanyahu, and others whose foreign information is now being seen in these emails might clam up in the future, or their counterparts might do the same.
So, Nathan, on that second order harm, is this such above and beyond what we've already seen the last couple of years with a fear that Americans just can't keep anything secret given all the leaks that we've had?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point. I mean, it ties in very nicely with the government's inability to prevent massive data dumps of the variety engineered by Snowden, Manning, and others. Another useful context for thinking about this is the massively ramped up prosecutions of leakers we've seen under the Obama administration. In the previous seven decades of the Espionage Act, there are one or two or three prosecutions, but since 2009, I think we're in almost double digits now. We may actually have crossed into double digits. So one of the things that Espionage Act defendants, leakers, have said is it's not fair to treat us as low-level employees very harshly where White House officials get to leak with impunity. It will be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out should the FBI start looking at Secretary Clinton in particular, whether there will be a similarly hands-off approach to a cabinet secretary and special treatment of the sort that lower-level functionaries have been complaining about in other cases.
With the exception, notable exception of General Petraeus, can one of you remind us exactly what he was convicted of?
Well, yes, he was convicted of violating the law against mishandling classified information. He was storing in his office, home office in Arlington, Virginia, black books, as he called them, handwritten notebooks that contained highly, highly classified information, identities of covert operatives, military strategy, conversations that he'd had with the president. He then provided copies of those notebooks to his mistress slash biographer, and then received them back from her. It was initially alleged that he violated a whole host of statutes, including the Espionage Act, for having leaked highly classified information. In the end, he was allowed to plead to a much, much reduced charge of mishandling classified information. That's only a misdemeanor. He avoided jail time altogether and had to pay a fine under the plea agreement, a fine that the presiding judge actually increased because it was thought to be insufficiently high. So Petraeus, very high profile, but when you compare the sentence he received to the sentence imposed on, for instance, Manning, or that Snowden faces, or somebody like Sterling, Jeffrey Sterling, he seems to have gotten a relatively light slap on the wrist relative to what he could have been charged with and relative to what others have been charged with.
No, and Nathan, you'd add to that the fact that Clinton CIA Director John Deutsch was actually pardoned before he was even charged with mishandling classified information by handling on a home laptop computer a number of documents that, you know, that he knew to be highly classified, and doing so fairly regularly. He was in the process at the end of the Clinton administration of pleading to a misdemeanor charge of mishandling classified information, and was pardoned by President Clinton in a midnight pardon without consulting with either the FBI or the pardon attorney.
Now, on the security issue, I mean, we hear so much these days about the hacking on all fronts, whether it's AOL email accounts of Blumenthal or members of the Bush family, but even U.S. government email has had its own security problems. So how do we know, and does it matter whether government transmission systems are any more secure than their private counterparts?
Well, some of them are and some of them aren't. I currently, and I imagine Shannon is too, and Adam, perhaps you as well, currently am enjoying a one-year all-expenses-paid credit service monitoring from the U.S. government thanks to the OPM hack. The government doesn't seem to be very good at maintaining the security of unclassified networks. However, the government's classified networks are a different story. You know, they actually are much more impregnable, not infallible, of course, nothing is, but considerably more impregnable than what you would expect to see on a private server or a commercially available web mail application.
When there are breaches, this is Shannon again, when there are breaches of a government system, containment is not necessarily easy, but it is easier than use of a private system for official purposes.
So a lot has been made out of by the campaign out of classification markings. Does it matter? Is there a difference between a document that is marked classified versus the information within the sensitive nature of the information contained within it?
The answer to that is plainly no. And let's take the example of the confidential foreign government information that Nathan has discussed. Often, that information comes directly from a foreign government official. Sometimes it is marked, but as the State Department's own regulations recognize, usually it is not. So actually, it's the duty of the recipient of that information in the first instance to make sure it's properly classified, that is, properly marked classified. Foreign government information is presumptively classified, as Nathan noted. And so when you know, Clinton and her close colleagues are receiving this information, it's really no defense to say that it wasn't marked at the time, because it's generally not marked, but it's the obligation of the recipient to make sure that it does get marked. So all that defense merely amounts to, well, we didn't do our job.
Yeah, this is Nathan. Just to add to that, there may actually be a sense in which the absence of classification markings makes it worse, right? Especially when we're considering the top secret information derived from NSA or other intelligence agencies. This stuff was marked when the State Department got it. The fact that it wasn't marked on Hillary's server means that somebody had to affirmatively remove the classification stamps. Probably not the secretary herself, but somebody close to her, and that's very problematic.
Right, or summarize that information, right? Someone looks at a classified satellite data and summarizes it without themselves derivatively classifying their emails.
Well, but that happens all the time, doesn't it? In litigation that might involve classification, that there would be unclassified summaries produced of the classified intelligence.
Well, unclassified summaries are, yeah, sure, that happens in the SIPA process, but the point of that is to make sure there's no classified information you minimize out the classified information. Here we're talking about simply restating what's in a classified record, apparently that's the description of what's going on here, without actually classifying the restatement. So it's basically taking the classified information and just putting it into another document.
And for listeners, the SIPA you're referring to is the Classified Information Procedures Act.
Correct, which is a statute that deals with minimizing handling classified information in criminal litigation.
Now, if we're pushing up on Q&A time. If the classified information had been spilled on government servers, on the unclassified government servers, understanding that there are easier containment processes for this, would that also change the analysis under the criminal statutes and mishandling classified, the Espionage Act issues, if Hillary had been using government email addresses?
Well, go ahead, Nathan. Sorry.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I'll be quick. I'm not sure that it does. So both of the statutes that we've talked about refer to unauthorized locations. A government unclassified system is not authorized for the use of classified information in the same way that a private system is not. So, both a private system and an unclassified system are comparably unauthorized. So I'm not sure that it would make a difference from a criminal liability standpoint. But as Shannon said before, there's the operational point. It's much easier to contain a breach on a government server, and it's much easier to do a forensics analysis to determine, your counter espionage exposure if you have control of the server. It's a lot harder to do that if it's in a warehouse someplace in New Jersey.
So the one caveat to that I would add is simply that the statute that Nathan mentioned earlier, 18 U.S.C. 973 subsection F, has a recklessness standard, and it's basically if you share information recklessly with an uncleared person, there is criminal liability. I would simply suggest that the private server does sort of raise the stakes for recklessness. She's sending out her email address to people saying, here's my private email address, send me whatever you want to send me here, knowing that a lot of the information that comes back may be presumptively classified. I'd suggest that while Nathan is generally correct that that there shouldn't be much difference between government server and private server, the mere existence of sort of an offline dark server in this context does seem to me to have some implications for how reckless her conduct was.
With that, we've got about 20 minutes for questions. I think Dean can corral any questions from callers that that you may have, and we'll open up the floor.
Yes, in a moment we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we're going to start with two questions. Before we go to our first caller, let me just make a quick announcement that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be discussing the new EPA rule, the waters of the U.S. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Then on Friday, also at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about the implementation of the Obergefell, the gay marriage case. Today, of course, we're talking about the sharing of government information and emails. We've got two questions. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, Larry Callahan. For those who don't know me, may not know my background, for years I was in the Justice Department, ending in legislative affairs. Before that, I was in the Army at the Defense Communications Agency. At the Defense Communications Agency, I had a number of the clearances disclosed here, and one or two of them also later on at Justice. Let me say a few words about them to give you an idea of how they are treated. At the Defense Communications Agency, these things you've occasionally seen the word discussed code word clearance. What code word clearance means, which no one I have seen explained in press, means the actual name of the clearance is classified. Exhibit A is talent keyhole. For years, I had a TK clearance forever in the sense. TK was long before it was ever, TK, talent keyhole. Years ago, in the books, Falcon and the Snowman, these two kids who were working for an American company disclosed to the Russians the existence of talent keyhole, some of the documents that were obtained by that satellite. So we know it was known to the Russians. Long after that disclosure, long after those guys were arrested, long after the book Falcon and the Snowman was printed, talent keyhole remained classified. One classification clearance I had also has two initials, and the way I figure out whether or not I can discuss them is to put those initials into Google. If you put TK into Google, even some years ago, it would come out with talent keyhole. I have a clearance, and I can put it in. Let's say it's AA, and it comes out Alcoholics Anonymous. It never reaches the security clearance. So when you're talking about code word clearances, you're talking about some heavy-duty stuff that she's got on her damn computer at home, which is unbelievable. I worked at the Justice Department, DOD, in a pretty secure building. When you left the government, you can't believe the debriefing we went through with all our documents. I didn't have a justice. You just don't have that group of documents with the above top secrets. So it was much quicker. And it's just incomprehensible to me that this kind of thing could occur. But I thought you might be interested in the fact, because you always see the word code word. Now, someone there, you guys are men and women, are more involved than I am. But at least in the old days, code word clearance meant that it was so highly classified that the name itself was classified. I just wonder if that's still true.
Either of our experts want to respond?
Yeah, this is Nathan. I think it is still the case. I refer you back to the David Petraeus matter. In the documents associated with the plea agreement, there's a description, actually a transcript of a conversation that Petraeus had with his biographer, in which he's describing the contents of the black book notebooks. And he says, you know, there's some pretty serious stuff in there. There's code word stuff in there. So very much in keeping with what you just described.
Well, and I'd simply add that I disagree with Larry that finding it on Google is a justification or excuses public disclosure of that information. I mean, there is information that is classified in the public domain that that we cannot confirm if we are cleared into a program. So And you know that issue comes up quite a bit in questions about classification. And in fact, from what I gather from the news reports, the State Department is currently trying to put together a brief on the two or three classified documents that were classified top secret, and argue that the information was otherwise publicly available. And unless they can trace the source of that information, of the particular disclosure, they had two public sources, you know, that's a real problem for them.
By the way, this is Callahan again. What I meant to say was, if I find it on the computer, I can tell people I had a TK clearance. There's no way in the world I am going to discuss what I saw when I had that clearance. The difference is, with respect to that other clearance, I can't even acknowledge that that clearance exists. But that someone has a TK clearance, I think there's nothing wrong with admitting it. It's what's wrong is talking about what you were reading or hearing in a briefing or reading in a classified document. So I don't think there's anything wrong with telling someone you had a TK clearance, but I never even mentioned the other one. But maybe you misunderstood me. Or do you think it's wrong to tell someone you had a TK clearance?
Well, all I'm saying is that the existence of information in the public domain is does not excuse those who have clearance to that information to disclose, and I'm not making a judgment on this particular circumstance.
Because people have top secret clearances, they tell people they had them. I don't see the difference when telling them you had a TK. When you start discussing the information or putting it into documents available to everybody and their brother, I think that's a very different situation.
Well, once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got over 10 minutes left. We've got just one question pending, so we've got time for other calls. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. I also understand from some callers joining us late that our email reminder went out quite a bit late for this call. Just a reminder to those of you who are joining us late, this whole call has been recorded. It should be posted on our website perhaps later today, certainly no later than tomorrow, if you were unable to hear the whole call. For now, let's take another question.
Yes, this is Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. Given the very real possibility that the Chinese, Russians, et cetera, were able to hack into Hillary Clinton's emails, have our intelligence agencies had to take steps to deal with that possibility by changing procedures, withdrawing undercover agents from who knows where, or taking extraordinary measures, even short of knowing that her emails were hacked?
Hi, this is Shannon. Look, we don't know exactly what steps have had to be taken. We do know that the FBI is leading an assessment right now, which is the first step in containing any potential leaks. The FBI goes through, with the assistance of the intelligence community, goes through a fairly rigorous process to A, determine whether there were leaks, and B, determine what harm to the national security might have accompanied those leaks. And you know, it's almost best we don't know. But at this point, there hasn't been a lot of detail about you know, what has been hacked. I would say there's been a great deal of speculation by people in the intelligence community that information, the information in her server, was almost certainly compromised.
Professor Sales, do you have anything on this point?
Just a small point. The assessment that Shannon mentioned is really important to figuring out the scope of the problem. And that's why it was really important for Secretary Clinton to have turned over the server as quickly as possible. They eventually did turn it over to the FBI only after years of it remaining in private custody. The intelligence services, our adversary foreign intelligence services have had a couple-year head start on us in potentially exploiting this information if they did, in fact, gain access to it. So the FBI and the intelligence services are going to have to play catch-up in figuring out, you know, what was compromised and how to fix it.
Let me make another call for questions here. We don't have any questions pending. If you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a question that might be, while we're waiting, difficult for either of you to answer. You might want to pass. I don't know. But what do things look like going forward in terms of the time frame and how things unfold? Is there any sense of that, or are there just too many unknowables to even make a guess at how things unfold from here?
It is difficult to know for sure because there are so many different inquiries going on right now. I mean, there are several committees of jurisdiction on the Hill in both the House and the Senate that are investigating matters relating to her email server or matters in which her email server plays a role. Benghazi, the House Select Committee on Benghazi being one of them, the Senate Judiciary is looking more at the use of the server itself. With respect to those investigations, one of the key technical players in this, a former campaign staffer who Hillary Clinton paid on the side to both set up and maintain her server, both while he was a campaign staffer and then later after she had given him a job at the State Department, has indicated to the committees that, or actually has pled, the formally invoked his Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination in private sessions with the committees. The committees are contemplating whether to immunize his testimony, trying to do that in conjunction with the DOJ investigation. That process is going to take a little time, and I could see this inquiry stretching well into the election year for sure.
Gentlemen,
real quickly, these classified information investigations don't get wrapped up overnight. They typically stretch on for years. The Petraeus investigation lasted several years. The Manning and Snowden investigations took and are taking an awful long time. So I wouldn't expect this to go away tomorrow. This is something, now we're talking more about political implications than legal ones. This is something that the Clinton campaign is probably going to be dealing with for the rest of the election cycle.
We do have another question.
Go ahead.
Let's see if we can spend our last 5 minutes perhaps on this final question.
Callahan, again, since no one was on, I was add one more little thing. The seriousness with which all of this is considered, that at DOJ, when you got the SITK and the anonymous clearance, you were taken by car out to the CIA, where you were briefed on the clearance by Robert Gambino, who was the head of security at CIA. We always called him Carlo for obvious reasons because it was funny. But that's how serious this stuff was considered. They didn't even brief you at the DOJ. You went out there. And again, it's unimaginable that she'd have this stuff on at home, to repeat myself. Sorry.
I'll close with a question, Dean. This is Adam. Has this situation highlighted a need for any statutory or regulatory changes or modifications, or is what is currently on the book adequate to handle the situation? It just hasn't arisen in this way before.
Well, I think the statutes, the criminal statutes governing classified information, are not exactly models of clarity. They are notoriously ambiguous and confusing, but we've been dealing with that ambiguity and confusion for, in the case of the Espionage Act, nearly a century. There are good reasons to reconsider the Espionage Act and bring some needed clarity to the statute, but I think that's a broader problem, and it's not one that is unique to the issues of, you know, mishandling classified information allegedly here with with Secretary Clinton's server.
And on the question of simply federal records and not dealing with classified information, there are a number of statutes and regulations that you know were pretty clearly implicated in these circumstances, and that didn't slow down this particular train. I suspect you will see some review government-wide of private email use. Look, I would say it's fairly commonplace for individual employees to use their home email for official purposes on occasion, and you know, myself included. But whenever I did, I simply copied my work email when I didn't have ready access to my work email system. I would simply do what the law now requires. I think you'll probably see some government-wide review of practices and policies. It wouldn't surprise me because, you know, the federal government is very good at making reactive law.
Well, Adam, it looks like we've exhausted the questions from the audience. I don't know if we want to give each of our speakers maybe 60 seconds to express a final thought here.
Final thought. Okay. Let me think of a final thought. There's the question of legal sanction, and then there's the question of political sanction. There's a lot of uncertainty about whether the criminal law statutes were actually broken, and if so, by whom. The investigation will stretch on for some time, and we may eventually have answers to that, and criminal sanctions may or may not be imposed. But I think the more immediate scenario, the more likely scenario, and one that we're already seeing, is that this scandal raises some political costs for Secretary Clinton's campaign. It may be that the Assistant United States Attorney doesn't file charges, but it may be that voters sour on her campaign and start looking elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think we are seeing that. I think the political cost of what Secretary Clinton has done certainly far outweighs whatever interest in, you know, personal privacy that she had when she undertook these steps. She was hoping to keep her records from the sort of fishbowl of modern FOIA requests and congressional inquiries. I would suggest that had she not done what she did, she probably would have gotten a lot less scrutiny than she's currently getting. There's no question that the political price that she's paid has been quite significant, because the polls are showing that Americans just don't trust her right now and don't believe she's telling the truth.
Well, gentlemen, we are out of our budgeted time. This is Dean Reuter. I want to thank our experts, especially Adam Perlman for moderating, but also Shannon Coffin, of course, and Nathan Sales. We certainly appreciate you joining us today. To the audience, thank you as well for joining us. And a reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be talking about the EPA's new rules on waters of the U.S. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.